call the House State Affairs Committee to order on January the 17th. Are we on teleconference?
Not for this time.
Not for this time.
We are, no, okay.
Second.
At 8:45 in Juneau, 1990. First piece of legislation we have before us is Senate Bill 226, simply stated, misdemeanors of the person who commits criminal trespass in the first degree while under the influence of drugs or alcohol and with a gun on his or her possession would be guilty of misconduct involving possession of a firearm in the first degree. Makes the offense a Class C felony with up to $50,000 fine and 5 years in jail. I just, my thoughts here and staff recommendation that we were, as we pass this out, I think it is good legislation, but we want to make sure that we don't just pass laws and don't give equal emphasis to rehabilitation. And as it relates to the alcoholics and drugs problem. We have people here that would like to testify on this. My thought, unless this has pretty well been studied, it's sponsor is Senator Binkley. Appears to be pretty straightforward. I would like to move it on out.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to
hear some testimony.
No. Do you want to hear the testimony?
It's pretty straightforward. I don't like to move anything out unless if somebody says, hey, I want to hear something about it. Maybe since Senator Binkley's office is want to testify, maybe we might just take the time to listen to that. I know you prepared for it this morning.
I really don't have anything to add, although I'd be happy to answer questions if you have something that...
Are there any questions anybody has?
Mr. Chairman, is there anyone else to testify? Is there someone from public safety or on this bill or...
I'm here from law to answer any questions if you have them about the bill.
Why don't you come on up here? So I'm getting, I like to run a relaxed committee, but it makes it a little difficult for my people when we don't have names.
Go ahead.
Sign in.
For the record, sir, my name's Lori Otto. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Thank you for being here.
We did work with Senator Binkley in drafting this piece of legislation, so I'm pretty familiar with it and can answer any questions you have. Mostly, I think the bill's aimed at addressing a situation that arises not infrequently in Senator Binkley's district of people who are drunk, who get guns, who go over to other people's houses. Lots of times because they are drunk, and because their reason for going over to somebody's house is unclear, we may not be able to prosecute them for burglary where we have to show what their intent was in going into somebody else's house. But the level of crime seems to be more serious than your run-of-the-mill misdemeanor if they're drunk in somebody's house where they don't belong and have a gun with them. And so this is aimed at increasing the penalty to a felony, which would not just allow for increased jail time, but would allow for felony probation supervision. It's something that we don't have for people convicted of misdemeanors as somebody to supervise them. And it was felt that the behavior was dangerous enough that it warranted some kind of probation supervision after a person got out of jail.
Eileen, you had a question? Excuse me.
Yes, I wanted to find out when it's a felony, how many years in jail would they be spending?
It's 0 to 5, and it's completely at the option of the judge, who would also be able to give somebody a suspended imposition of sentence or no jail time or just send them to a treatment program. But for somebody who is categorized as a worst offender, it's possible to get up to 5 years of jail, but that kind of sentence is not permissible for somebody convicted the first time.
Mr. Chairman, I have a concern on this bill because one of the things that I don't see is that the rehabilitative treatment that alcoholic or a substance abuser would be using, and to me that would be more helpful if they were to get treatment instead of just being put in jail without any treatment per se. So there's my concern.
All right.
Representative McLean, I think that the judge always has the option to require somebody to participate in treatment rather than sending them to jail, and I know that Judge Jeffries in Barrow does that pretty frequently with people who have alcohol problems. This would not change the court's ability to do that. There are some problems that the criminal justice system is having right now with being able to require somebody to go to treatment as a result of a series of Court of Appeals opinions. But Representative Ulmer has introduced another piece of legislation that comprehensively addresses the need for rehabilitation in all criminal, with all criminal offenses, not just singling out this one. But and I frankly think that Representative Ulmer's bill is a great step in the direction of being able to get people into good treatment programs. But this bill addresses something entirely different. I mean, there's sort of two parts to criminal offenses. One is, what is the offense? And that's in Title 11. And two is, what happens to them if they're convicted? And that's in Title 12. Mm-hmm. So this addresses only the first half. And if you're interested in treatment and rehabilitation, like I say, Representative Ulmer has what I think is a real good bill coming before the legislature right now.
Is that satisfying?
It satisfies me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a. What would the penalty be for the possession of a firearm if the person weren't intoxicated? Is that right now? This would be a misdemeanor. Is that correct? So this is increasing the penalty to a Class C felony.
Well, possession of a firearm in Alaska is not a crime unless you're intoxicated. So right now,
went in and threatened somebody with a gun, and the homeowner was sober. Would that be a?
That would be a third degree assault, or if we can show that somebody went over to a person's house with the intent of threatening them with a gun, it would probably be charged as a first degree burglary. If somebody's not intoxicated, proving what their intent is becomes a lot easier.
And will it be difficult for the arresting officer to prove intoxication or under the influence of a drug? How do they, if the person said, I really wasn't intoxicated, if he went to the judge and said, do they do a breathalyzer, do they do any kind of?
They do whatever investigation appears to be warranted in the particular case, and it's just like the crime that exists right now, possession of a gun while intoxicated, it's the state's burden to prove that, and if the police officers don't gather evidence sufficient to prove that somebody was intoxicated, they probably won't be charged with the crime, and I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I guess that's how it fits in.
Thank you.
Is that satisfying?
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's objection, the chair will accept the motion and move it out of committee.
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
Are there any objections? So move. Thank you for your testimony. Next item, purse benefits for probation officers. The sponsor on this is Representative Swackhammer. Swack. You got me. Small typo here. Please spell Swack's name right.
That's all right, Mr. Chairman. I was in the third grade before I spelled it right.
I never got there. Go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do appreciate the early hearing for this bill. This is really a very straightforward piece of legislation, and basically it puts the probation and parole officers under the 20-year peace officer retirement. I think if you look inside the packet, we've provided you several examples of our rationale. And if the committee would permit me, I'd like to just talk from personal experience. As most members know, I spent 21 years with the troopers, and I've had an opportunity in those 21 years to work with probation and parole officers on a statewide basis. A person needs to understand exactly what their job entails and why that we would seem that it would be fitting that they fall under the 20-year retirement plan. These officers literally make arrests, conduct searches in an unsterile environment just like police officers do. There's many examples of when they've, and I know from personal experience, of times that we've assisted them in trying to deal with a lot of these people. And if you don't think that there is some danger involved here, I'd like to just share some photographs with you. These hassles.
We made this whack.
Pictures are worth a thousand words, especially if they're my words. Your everyday probationer or parolee. I'd just like to tell you about one incident that really hit home. In Kenai, we had a probation and parole officer that there were not mere threats. His house was firebombed. He had extensive medical expenses as well as being scarred for life. And frankly, he is no longer in the state and is no longer a probation and parole officer. I have never understood during the time that I was a police officer why the probation and parole officers were not included in the 20-year retirement. This affects approximately 175 employees. If I'm incorrect, there are people here that can correct me on that. But I think it's long overdue. And there are people here from probation and parole that could give you more specifics. I tried to provide in your packet some examples.
Other questions from the committee? Alice?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I guess this is an education for me because I didn't realize that the probation officer was subject to that kind of dangerous situation. I guess I perceived that maybe the probation officer basically sat in a nice room with a person every week checking in and saying, you're straight, are you
might
maintain the conditions of your parole.
Mr. Chairman, I would encourage the committee to question the probation and parole officers that will be here to testify and that are on teleconference. That it's even becoming increasingly so, and as you know, I chair the subcommittee on corrections, and I put a lot of emphasis in probation and parole simply to try to keep the revolving door and to try to have less repeat offenders. Well, the truth of the matter is that if you're going to do an adequate job, which I like to say that from my experience, we enjoy one of the lowest recidivism rates of those people that are on parole than anywhere in the United States. It's about 4% for the national average, is in double digits. So, but that's the only way that they can adequately supervise. They don't just come to the office. They make home visits. They have to conduct searches, and we've gone into the intensive supervision mode in trying to save costs down the road. And we're very hopeful that program will show that it is effective. But obviously, when you go somewhere unannounced or to make an arrest, the one picture of there with the guy with the leather jacket and the shotgun, this sometimes is what they're faced with. So I can think of no better group of people that should be deserving of this.
What's the practical effect of making it 20 years? Is the the way the service is calculated, it's your base pay period times the number of years times some formula. So if you retire after 20 years, you're going to have, it's just the opportunity to retire and fall into the system. Is that correct?
Yes. My memory tells me it allows them to retire after 20 years of continual service. The first 10 years, I believe it's 2%. And every additional year over 10 is 2.5, which ends up about 45% is, and my calculation is right. Basically, when you're under that type of stress, and the idea behind the retirement is to keep quality people, to also try to have some sort of positive turnover, because I can tell you that police officers and people that have to do this for a living become very stressful. Not only stressful, but it's downright dangerous. I was glad after 21 years that I'm doing something different.
You're
not that it's any safer, but...
Without stress.
Right. Right, but it's stress, less stress.
Well, we have some people that are online to testify. Why don't you just sit this way? You don't have to hop up and down and present.
There are people here, Mr. Chairman, that...
We can call them up.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Reese, why don't you go ahead and testify?
Yes, sir.
Get close to your microphone, please.
I'm Lou Reese. I'm Chief Probation Officer in Fairbanks, and... I'm testifying on behalf of the Alaska Probation and Parole Association, which is a nonprofit professional association of probation officers statewide, testifying in support of the passage of HB 396. And I would, as part of my testimony, call to the committee's attention that we are one class of peace officer defined by Alaska, the statute in the state, that are not included under peace officer retirement. We deal with adult felons and are dealing with the same offender that police officers are dealing with and that correctional officers are dealing with and are not covered by the 20-year retirement. I would support what Representative Schwackhammer said regarding some of the benefits to the state for allowing a 20-year retirement for probation officers. The job is physically demanding. Officers are routinely and regularly involved in making arrests of offenders. And the job is very stressful. It would provide an additional benefit to the state in that it would allow a turnover and maintaining a vigorous and a younger, or at least it should, a younger enforcement arm of the Department of Corrections. We believe, too, is a part of one of the reasons for putting us under it is the obviously the demands of the job, and also it's been an issue that's been around the state for about 18 or 20 years. We've been considered in the past and not been included, and we believe that as a matter of fairness and possibly recognizing the performance that these officers do for the state, that it would be the right thing to do to include us under the peace officer retirement. I don't know if there's any questions from the committee. I'd be glad to try and take those at this time.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Reese. There are no questions from the committee members. Is there anyone else online to testify?
This is Keith Stell in Juneau. I'm the Chief Probation Officer for Southeast. Without trying to repeat everything that Representative Schwackhammer and Lou Reese have said, I would like to just read a paragraph out of the Alaska Probation and Parole Association position paper, though, that kind of emphasizes our position here. Alaska Statute 01.10060 defines peace officer as follows. Peace officer means any officer of the troopers, members of the police force, of any incorporated city or borough, United States Marshals and their deputies, and other officers whose duty it is to enforce and preserve the public peace. statute 11.81, 900, subsection 38 defines peace officer as a public servant vested by law with a duty to maintain public order or to make arrests. Whether the duty extends to all offenses or is limited to a specific class of offenses or offenders. In addition to the counseling and rehabilitative aspects of probation and parole work, the State of Alaska class specifications for probation officers provide that probation officers investigate cases of parole or probation violators, compile evidence required to effect the suspension of parolee or probationer, and apprehend violators for return to custody. Furthermore, the class specs require that the probation officer cooperate with local and state police, institutional and judicial officials in the supervision of parolees and probationers, and maintain personal contact at office and periodically visit with parolees and probationers to assist them with problems of social readjustment. In other words, probation officers make arrests. We arrest probation parole violators, we take them to jail, book them into jail in exactly the same manner as any other peace officer, and we're defined in the same manner as peace officers. Likewise, probation officers are required to meet probationers and parolees in the field, often at their residence, and these situations are often tense and hostile. Probation officers are required to search probationers and parolees in their residence for the presence of drugs, stolen property, weapons. We're authorized to carry firearms. We make arrests with other peace officers and police officers. I guess what I'm saying here, the downside of this this work is it is stressful and it is somewhat hazardous. I have with me a probation officer in Juneau who's been in the field for some 15 years, Bob Collins, probation officer 3, who could give you some examples of daily activities of probation officers if you would like to hear that.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Collins?
Yes, thank you very much. This is Bob Collins. I'm a probation officer 3 in Juneau. I've been with the Department of Corrections 16 years. I carry an active caseload of probationers and parolees, and I thought it might be helpful to just recount some of my experiences in supervising these folks. I recently had a probationer who hired a private investigator to try to pick up adverse information on myself and my family to present in court because I filed a petition to revoke his probation. And another probationer who drove by the probation office and shot at our windows with a rifle because he was angry at the way that he was being supervised. This man is a drug dealer and also convicted of sexually abusing children, and we were supervising him very carefully and he was angry. Later, when I was arresting another probationer and booking him into Lemon Creek Correctional Center, I was jumped by this fellow who intended to try to thrash me. Several months ago, I arrested a probationer at his trailer. He would not come out, and I summoned assistance from the Alaska State Troopers and the Juneau City Police, and the 5 peace officers and myself kicked in the door and went inside, and he was there drunk, and he had a rifle close at hand. I searched one of my probationers several years ago and found a machine gun and 7 or 8 ounces of cocaine in his home. Down in the Kenai area, one of our probation officers was firebombed by a probationer. They tossed a bottle of lit gasoline in his window while he was sleeping at night, and he escaped, but with serious burns, and he has since left the Department of Corrections. 2 years ago, one of the people that I supervised, one of my probation officers, left the Department of Corrections because her stress level had gotten so bad that she was getting sick all the time and was under a doctor's care. Then she has left the Department of Corrections. She does not have these symptoms anymore of asthma and constant colds and neck aches and things like that. I'm not a doctor and I can't say, well, those symptoms were definitely caused by stress, but it sure looked like it to me, and they sure got better when she left. And I suppose last but not least, most of the people on our caseloads are in their 20s and are physically fit and strong and vigorous. And it's fine to deal with those people. people when you're in your 20s and 30s. But as you get into your 40s and 50s, it gets much more difficult to do battle with those folks. And for all those reasons, the danger and the stress and the physical demands, I certainly urge the committee to support this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions if any of the committee members have them.
I think your case is pretty well stated. Is it Ms. Robeson? She testified.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. And I'm testifying as a member of the Alaska Probation Parole Association. I am currently employed by the Department of Corrections as the Chief Probation Officer for the South Central Region. During my career, I have been employed as a temporary correctional officer, as a probation officer both in the institution and as a line officer in the community, and then more recently as a manager. Testifying today in support of House Bill 396, I believe that probation officers should be considered under 20-year retirement. As my colleague Lou Reese has pointed out, probation officers are considered peace officers. We deal with the same population under similar stress levels as the police and correctional officers who are currently under 20-year retirement. The police interact with the general public, they interact with misdemeanors, they interact with felons. Correctional officers oversee incarcerated populations of misdemeanors and felons. Our probation officers supervise caseloads of exclusively felons. And as I believe that Bob Collins has attested to, our officers have faced many of the same dangers and threats as the correctional and police officers. I would like to impress that these episodes that occur involving danger and threat against our officers are a regular occurrence. Yesterday I was informed by one of the supervisors that the phone messages for Monday contained a death threat against one of our line probation officers. Last week, I received a report that two of my officers had been splattered with urine during a subsequent search and arrest. We're currently waiting for the results of the offender's medical review, and we're hopeful that this offender is not a carrier of hepatitis B. I would like to briefly describe some of the responsibilities that our officers have. It is a common misperception that individuals supervised by our probation officers are first-time offenders with minor criminal history. This is not the case. It has not been unusual for our courts to follow a lengthy prison sentence with extended periods of probation supervision. With rare exception, our officers supervise all offenders receiving presumptive sentences when they are finally released on mandatory parole. Essentially, we supervise nearly all felons who are sentenced in the state of Alaska. In South Central Region alone, this represents approximately 1,800 felony offenders. Our officers are dealing with concentrated caseloads of individuals disposed to serious criminal behavior. They are not only responsible for enforcing the offender's compliance with court orders, but must be able to detect future criminal activity and provide for public protection. Unfortunately, the prognosis for many of our offenders is bleak. The resourcefulness and skills of our officers are continually pushed to the limit by the challenge presented by experienced criminals. Okay, the knowledge that is required of probation officers is extensive. They must be versed in areas of law enforcement and be able to effect arrests, conduct searches, transport offenders, and protect the community. The officers must serve as counselors to the offenders, helping them cope with problems and the responsibility of living as law-abiding citizens. The officers must be social workers, aware of the community that absorbs the offender and provides the offender with services. They must also be familiar with local, state, and federal laws that provide the officers authority and also control the felons. To provide a continuum on professionalism in the criminal justice system, I believe that it is imperative that probation and parole officers receive 20-year retirement. We're unable to hire good employees through the current career ladder, and correctional officers are not willing to sacrifice their retirement to become probation officers. Because of the demands and stress of the position, some of the employees have the endurance complete their career. I can count on one hand the number of full-time probation officers that have retired on a regular retirement since 1976. I see daily the stress that my officers face, and I have seen the cumulative effect of years of service in this job class. I can without reservation say it does take its toll on these people, their personal lives, their families, and their health. In conclusion, I would say that the bottom line is that the benefit to the citizens of Alaska will be an improved supervision of felony offenders and increased public safety. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions from any of the members. Please, just for the record, could we have your name and address, please?
Hey, my name is Elizabeth Robeson. My address is 4691 Caravelle Drive, Anchorage, Alaska.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I see, Bob, you're here. Would you like to testify on this since you head up the Division of Retirement and Benefits?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Stalnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. I'd like to welcome you all back. The bill before you, as Representative Swackhammer identified, would place probationary officers or probation officers under police and fire category under the public employees retirement system. They're currently covered under the provisions of the systems as all others, like the majority of state employees. I certainly am not in a position to comment on the testimony you heard today. I think it's all very accurate, and they're stating the positions that they feel. There is a cost to this bill because the provisions for police officers are more generous than they are for all others. There is the 20-year retirement that allows a member after 20 years of service. It doesn't have to be continuous, but it's 20 years of cumulative service as a peace officer to retire with an unreduced benefit. The provisions for all others is you retire at age 50 with a reduced benefit or age 55 with an unreduced benefit. So that is an advantage right there. And the only other difference would be that there is a little more generous benefit that is received. As Representative Swackhammer stated, the benefit formula is 2% for the first 10 years and then 2.5% for every year above 10 years. For all others, it's 2% for the first 10 years and 2.25% for the next 10 years and then 2.5% for anything over 20 years. Because of the cost of the bill, the division or the department does not support the bill. But then that's the issue for the legislature to decide. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have on the fiscal cost of the bill or any other questions you might have on the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, would you indicate what the cost is to the state and also how you arrived at those figures?
Through the chair, Representative Swackhammer. The estimated cost to the systems would be an increase in the contribution rate of 0.03%. That calculates out when you use the assumed salaries for the state of Alaska to be a cost of $166,000 a year. This is based on 175 members in the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services. And the difference in benefits that they would see would receive as a result of being peace officers as opposed to all others.
Mr. Chairman, I think there might be some misunderstanding. Last time I read my bill, it covered people in corrections and not in health and social services.
Through the chair, Representative Swackhammer, the bill covers probation officers. Probation officers are in the Department of Health and Social Services as they are in the Department of Corrections, as I understand the bill. I mean, unless I'm misreading the bill. I would also add, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think if you were to exclude probation officers in one department as opposed to another department, we would be faced with the same issue next session or later this session with that group of people saying, I'm as much a probation officer as the people in corrections are probation officers, as we're faced right now with wildland firefighters wanting peace officer service, park rangers wanting peace officer service, and other quasi-police agencies or employees wanting peace officer service.
Mr. Chairman, he is correct.
Any other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious. We've been talking about the parole officer working in corrections. What is a parole officer in health and social services? What kind of duties does that person perform?
Through the chair, Representative Hanley, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the Department of Health and Social Services. I imagine perhaps some of the other probation officers might be a little more familiar with the duties provided by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Mr. Chairman, Lou Reese in Fairbanks, maybe I could provide some information regarding that question.
Just give your name as your comment. Go ahead.
Lou Reese, Chief Probation Officer, Northern Region, President of APPA. I guess to provide some history in time, until about December of 1980, probation and parole officers were both juvenile and adult, and they were in the Division of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services. At that time, the division was split. Juvenile officers became employed by the Division of Family and Youth Services. Adult correctional probation officers stayed in the Division of Corrections, and subsequently became the Department of Corrections. Since that time, there has been a, to my knowledge anyway, a difference in the dual path in this series. For example, approximately a year or 2 years ago, adult probation and parole officers were placed under the Police Standards Council. Juvenile officers were not included in that legislation. Regarding some of the duties that the juvenile probation officers perform, I haven't worked in that area for a number of years, but in the past they would arrest juveniles that were under the age of majority. They would supervise them according to the court-ordered conditions of release that were established by Superior Court, and they would also write predisposition reports, which are similar to adult pre-sentence reports. Other than that, I can't be any more specific. I haven't worked in that area since about 1980. I would make some distinctions regarding the adult probation parole officers, and those are that, as I stated earlier, we are under the Police Standards Council, as other law enforcement officers are in the state, other correctional officers, police officers, and that is one primary distinction between juvenile officers and the adult officers. I believe, to the best of my knowledge, there are approximately 120 adult officers in the state. I don't know, I'm certain that Mr. Stonemaker could identify if the committee chose to make a distinction between the two types of employees, what that cost reduction would be to the state's portion of contribution. I hope that helps.
Thank you very much for your explanation.
Mr. Chairman, it would not be my intent to separate the two. I think that there's justification for the juvenile probation officers as well.
Just a comment from my point of view. We're talking about money. I think in my way of thinking, the way the person earns their livelihood here and the way the average person in the building does is quite a distinction. I think it's a problem that can be best dealt with in finance. As far as the policy and the rightness of it, I think Representative Schwackhammer has good legislation here. We can't pass tough laws and then just kick them out the door and expect peace officers and people who have to deal with people who just plain don't respect society. And we have to give them the tools, and I think longevity is certainly a part of a tool, a desire to be a career officer in this person, in this case. So I would like to move this out with individual recommendations. Representative Hamlin?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill number 396 to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations.
Any objection? So moved. If the committee members could stay for just a couple of minutes or so.
Can I have a motion, please?
I'd like the cut they gave me, sir.
Would
you like me to
go? Beg pardon? Yeah, there's some of them, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't like that much of it. I thought probation officers
would like. I think you sat in an office and you Johnny came in or Mr. Smith came in and you said, are you maintaining the conditions of your parole?
Yeah.
Are you, take your urine sample down the hall and leave it, and I'll see you next week at 2 o'clock. And I guess that's what I thought a probation officer. And as far as working with juveniles, I think some of our juveniles are probably some of our most dangerous criminals.
Tell me about it.
Because I think they perceive that their punishment is much less severe than that of an adult.
Do they carry firearms?
Yeah.
Here they were saying that I was authorized to carry firearms.
Authorized to carry firearms.
They're authorized, but do they actually carry them in the field, in the rural areas?
I think I would if I were a probation officer, but that's probably individual.
I think they do. The other thing that I couldn't understand is that they were authorized to carry firearms as probation officers, but I know that the village public safety officers are not authorized to carry.
So I wonder how their training differs. I don't know much about the probation officer, how old. They have to be in the federal system. Law enforcement people are allowed to retire with 20 years, mm-hmm. but you have to be age 50. The FBI, I don't know if that's changed, but you could retire with 20 years, but you had to be 50, which is different from a lot of other federal. You have to be older in a lot of other federal service. Mm-hmm. Here, I don't know. I don't know how old you have to be a probation officer. How old the entry level usually is. Or what kind of training they have compared to maybe the village public safety officer.
But see, they're on danger every day, you know.
Exactly.
Oh,
a lot of danger.
Chance to sign on those.
It's because of that liability insurance for village public safety officers.
That they don't get to carry a firearm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like a big stick or something, huh?
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. Well, they can't carry any weapons.
I wouldn't want to be a village public safety officer.
That's why they have such a heck of a time finding village public safety officers.
Just one thought. I just wanted to talk to you briefly about the next legislation that we'll be bringing up, HB 397, the Department of Information Services. And I know everybody's, oh my goodness, a department. Kay Brown and myself have put what we might call an information package, access to public information. And all of them kind of fit in together. And then even the thought that in the University of Alaska there needs to be more emphasis on this thing called information. We conducted an audit on the telecommunications department. I don't know, did you all have a chance to take a look at that? I might ask staff to give each one of you a copy again. It was a mess. They were using program receipts to buy anything that they wanted, and we got that under control. And in fact, there were some changes in personnel there. Then last year, you'll recall, on the budget, they brought up the purchase of a $6 million computer, and Kay Brown and I both turned them down and say, go back and do your homework. There's too much emphasis on buying new machines. and not being efficient, sitting down and organizing your information. Then, in addition to that, the product, the resource is buried down in the bowels of the Department of Administration, and you get what you call the data processing people who more or less don't even look at what their information is spitting it out. They just spit the thing out. So we bore down pretty hard on the interim audit. I want all software that you purchased, and we are talking about significant dollars. We're talking about anyway $12 million purchases of software that have never been used. Now, of course, when software and other stuff comes out as a line item, the average legislature, myself included, tends to say, well, you know, they might need it. They're trying to get another payroll system up. They don't know if that payroll system is going to swamp the computer that they've got. Now, during the interim, there was quite a battle. Andrews wanted to buy a 3084 computer. Now, that all that simply means, well, let me say, they wanted to buy a 1983 computer, which nobody is making parts for. Now, that's an exaggeration, but I'm just trying to get it in focus. As opposed to adding on to a 1989 computer that was in Anchorage. Well, it gets the old Juneau-Anchorage battle. Gosh, we don't want to quite upgrade their stuff. And so I just, the thing that bothered me most is they use the Telecommunication Information Council, which is supposed to be a policy-making body as far as information policy is concerned. And Andrews was there, and he was just going to ram this computer thing through, come hell or high water. And I just challenged him, and all of his technical people had said, it's a bad deal, it's a bad deal. But this administration is just trying to patch stuff together and leave a ticking time bomb with the next administration. And I see the disasters it could create. Let's say, for example, in the second week of the permanent fund, crash, the system goes, or payroll, or anything. We have moved all of our eggs into the digitally driven basket to sort our information, let alone what we as individuals need out here. They are still staggering around with a dinosaur mentality. And I realize the minute you start talking technical stuff, people just begin to yawn. Well, as a result, and I don't know, it was directly from what we did, Andrews just gave up over there, and he got out of there, and the next one isn't a lot better, so we're slapping one audit on them after another, and that tends to keep them busy. And we just had the audit team in here yesterday. The audit won't come out until February, and they say, candidly, they don't know where the stuff is. Now, if this was done in any other department that people understood, there would be hell to pay. I intend, before I leave this building, to get that outfit over there, a service-oriented outfit. And the only way it's going to be done is to begin to have it organized separately. You get a new administration and they stick it way down the bottom of the thing. It actually is as important as the other stuff that DOA has. Now, maybe back in the beginning when you microfiched everything and you Xerox stuff, but this stuff is being driven at terrific speeds. And it's absolutely essential in the area of economic development, law, public policy, that, number one, the public have access to this information. My God, the legislature doesn't even have access to the information, let alone the public. And we have a small example of a problem right now, and it can be magnified. For example, the tourism marketing thing relies on the state processing electronically part of the information. We have an attorney general's opinion, which I kind of question, but nevertheless, it's because of this opinion, they say that's public information. Well, if that isn't handled properly, it could blow the whole tourism marketing thing apart, which is a major contribution. So we have to begin to treat information seriously, and the only way that we can do is take an information management concept. It is an issue that I'm not a know-it-all on, but I recognize its importance. I mean, so we will start the hearing on Thursday on it, tomorrow. The person that you will have online, and I want you to really don't feel intimidated by the issue. You don't have to know anything about it. I mean, you function on information if you're going to make good laws. We down here, that's what state is all about. We can't function without good laws. So we are going to have a gentleman named Ed Levine from Florida.
He was on during the
Yes, interview. Right. And feel free. I just don't want to drag in dog and pony shows here and you not. I want you to tear the thing apart. I want you to ask questions on it. We're lucky we've got two referrals, this committee and finance.
And this is on the central computer?
That's part of it, right? This isn't going to be on the mainframe issue. This is going to be on the concept of raising the processing of information to a cabinet level.
Oh, and you're creating a new department?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have all of... I know, that's your first reaction. Well, it is. Hey,
well, what the hell are we talking about?
And even with the administration, they say, well, leave it to the next administration. Let me tell you, the history of this is nobody knows anything about it. They bring somebody that's got a PhD in computers, and they go over there and screw the thing up. If this state is to move ahead in the 90s as oil declines, we have to be sharper. We have to know how to use the information that we have at hand. Part of our problem in these lawsuits with the other companies. Hey man, they've got that information at their fingertips. We struggle around. We don't even, sometimes as we change from administration to administration, we don't know where the stuff is. I'm not asking that just because I'm chairman that you're already fine, you take care of it. This is going to be an emerging issue for the 90s, the use of information. Especially with the accelerated speed that these boxes that they have both on our desks and over there. So anything that you need, and I'm not going to move it out of committee tomorrow, I have no intention to. I want to build a body of information. I want you to feel you're a part of what we're doing here. Most of the laws that we pass in the building, those that have got any connotation of the future to them, I'll let the next people take care of it. We're constantly patching wheels, changing spark plugs. That's not always the truth. Occasionally we get some innovative legislation through, but this public access, which Brown will bring forward, and this Center for Communications and the Information Sciences at the university, we consider to be a part of it. And it could be a... for the administration, they're looking for something to leave behind them. And one of Cooper's earliest statements in his inaugural address over here was trade, databases, access to information that will encourage economic development and the health and well-being of the state. So I just kind of wanted to talk to you about that. Don't expect any response from you now. Any information that you need, we don't want to load you down with stuff. Feel free to talk to staff on it, but most important of all, when Levine comes on tomorrow, he's going to talk about it, 10 or 15 minutes, the Florida experiment. There are people out there that are eager to help, not just us, but to other states, recognizing the urgency and the importance of this. Then secondly, you saw we have four pieces of legislation, we moved it through. You've known in the year that you've worked with me, I'm not one that says, if you move my bill, I move your bill. That's baloney. I mean, everybody's got their way of doing things, but if I can't go to another chair and on its own merits convince my legislation, I'm going to try and give the minority a fair shot on the hearing of their bills. We have a little bit of tit for tat going on the floor out there, and I understand that it's kind of the early flexing of muscles or what have you, but good thinking and good legislation is just not confined to the majority. If there's at any time in this committee that somebody has an objection to something, just hand a note over and say, hey, I'd like to not have this move out today. And I'll honor that. Have a good reason, though. And the reason better hadn't be, well, Representative such and such is holding my bill up. To me, that's not a good reason. I mean, I'm too far along in life to play a lot of silly damn games. I mean, if it's bad law, we can shoot it in the head. If it's good law, well, it needs to be heard, like swack hammers. The fiscal note on that will decide whether that thing lives or dies. But sometimes all of us tend to, sometimes we do, impose judgment on something that hasn't finalized itself. But this is our last session. There's some small chance that what I say won't be correct, but as far as I'm concerned, my job in this building is finished. I mean, I served in it 4 years before, and I've served in it 6 years now, and it's time to move on. If nothing else, to give me a fresh perspective in life. You heard people talk about me running for mayor. Well, that isn't even locked in. There's a lot of things I want to do. I want to write. I want to, most of all, make a contribution. So, if I seem a little bit more mellow and a little bit more laid back this year, that's the way I'm going to be. But I guess the thing that I really want you to know, it's a real pleasure to work with you people. I mean, you've got other committees, other problems, other priorities. He's loaded down with all kinds of stuff. If you don't show up, I'm going to kind of kid you a little bit, but try and give us four as early in the morning as you possibly can. If you're not going to come over, let us know. And by the same token, I'll try and do that for you downstairs. But let's enjoy it. Let's make it a committee that's fun, and it's a committee that's kind of relaxed, but by the same token, very serious about what it does. I guess what I'm saying by relaxed, let's not get carried away with a lot of posturing and silly nonsense. Let's make it enjoyable for each other. And that's about all I. That's my policy programs for this year.
I said I appreciate your comments.
I said, do you really want to leave here? Yeah. I'm going to take myself out of the game. I can still hit line drive, but do I want to do it? Move over and give somebody else a chance. Is utter enough. But anyhow, so that's kind of the tone under which I'll be working. And that far means that I got the short timer's attitude. Absolutely not. I mean, if the Lord gave me one more day to live, he'd say, what do you want to do? I says, hey, I'm going to do what I want to do right now twice as hard. So I tend to not. I tend to work maybe a little bit harder. But anyhow, thank you for your patience.
Just the general schedule you're shooting for is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday again?
Yep. May not so.
That's our plan.
Okay. Cool. And if it's a problem, just let us know ahead of time. This morning, my friend from Pawtucket was here earlier and said, Representative Boucher, I was here.
See what I got for getting here early?
Isn't that special?
Democrat and Pog. Yeah. Dennis gave me that cup because I was the first one.
Well, I too hope it's a committee. There's six very key people here that represent. It's a committee I hope we can all get to know each other a little bit. Whereas a little bit more respect. When we have to be on the opposite sides and occasionally butt helmets out here on the floor, that happens. But you get maybe an opportunity to, in a slightly different atmosphere, get to know each other better. Okay. Is there any comments any of you made?
No, I just appreciate your comments and your straightforward approach and your willingness to at least lay things out for us. And I appreciate knowing that I don't mean to hold things up. Sometimes if someone's here to testify, I feel like if I'm going to write due pass, maybe I just like to hear the justification.
Absolutely.
For a bill, so I'm not doing it to slow things down at all.
I understand.
But just to give me a little bit more information, so when that bill comes to the floor, I'll understand some of the foundation and some of the justification for passing a bill.
Well, like Eileen this morning on that gun thing.
On the rehabilitation.
She said she had heard enough, but she has some little concerns about that. And you have to decide whether that concern is deep enough to hold the bill up and get more information. If that is the case, I want you to have that information. I don't want you to have to put down no rec simply because I wanted to move the thing along. But then by the same token, I'll make that motion to move. If somebody's got a problem, that's all they got to do is say, and I'll tie them right into the sponsor, and I said, you better take care of that committee member's concern. All right.
Sounds fair.
Meeting adjourned, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.
Oh, good. Betcha.